Hello, I'm Michael Goodhart, Director of the Global Studies Center at the University of Pittsburgh. Today, we're bringing you a discussion of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, following up on a conversation begun 2 months ago at the coronavirus teach-in organized by the Global Studies and Asian Studies Centers. That event, held on February 12th, seems to have taken place in another world. At that time, the virus was confined to China, or so we thought. It was, both geographically and experientially, a distant phenomenon. Today, obviously, things appear rather different. I'm delighted to have back as my guests today two of our panelists from February, Megan Freeman and Mary Wabel. Megan Culler Freeman, MD, PhD, is a pediatric infectious diseases fellow at UPMC Children's Hospital. She completed her Bachelor of Science at the University of Kentucky and then earned her MD and PhD degrees at Vanderbilt University, where she studied coronaviruses. She then completed her pediatrics residency at Children's. Her research interests include pathogenesis and cell biology of RNA viruses and advanced tissue modeling, with a current focus on enterovirus D68, the hypothesized cause of acute flaccid myelitis in children. Dr. Mary Wabel is assistant professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, specializing in modern African history and the histories of public health, healing, and medicine. She received her PhD in history from Columbia University and currently holds a New Directions Fellowship from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation to pursue training in public health and parasitology. She's the author of The Politics of Disease Control, Sleeping Sickness in Eastern Africa, 1890 to 1920, published by Ohio University Press last year. Her current research focuses on the history of the neglected tropical diseases as a category in global health since the 1970s. Our conversation was recorded on April 10th. So, Megan, Mary, thanks so much for being here with us this morning. And I thought we could just begin the conversation by thinking back to the event in February and just ask each of you, what are the main developments, both in our understanding of the disease and in the social response, that have been most interesting to you since 2 months have gone by? It doesn't seem like very long, but it also seems like an eternity. So I thought I'd just start by getting your general reactions to what we've learned and maybe what we haven't learned since February.
I think for me, the thing that's been most striking is how incredibly big this has become. Certainly genetically, SARS coronavirus 2, or the cause of COVID, is very similar to SARS coronavirus 1, but it has had vast differences in kind of the global economic and health impacts that it has had as compared to SARS 1. And when I think back about at least how I was thinking about it in February, I don't think there was a wide prediction that it was going to be this big, and maybe not even as much of a prediction that it was going to hit this close to home.
I second that. I think that the scope of this, as we were thinking about what could possibly unfold when we were talking back in February, was in the realm of possibilities. But we were looking at a couple of different possible futures at that moment, in terms of containment and mitigation in East Asia or broader spread, and then what that would mean moving down the line. I think one of the things that's been most interesting for me to track and to pay attention to as a historian has been the way that people have been talking about what they should be doing and how this impacts their lives. So the sort of translation of early information about COVID-19, which focused on older demographic groups as being most at risk, which focused on men, the early guidance about mask wearing and so forth, as we have seen that change over time and have identified that younger people do die of this disease, mask wearing is useful for preventing infection, depending on who's talking. That's been a really interesting phenomenon to see play out, because there's been a really vigorous effort by a lot of people, I think, to try and educate themselves about best practices, but also a great deal of confusion and muddy messaging and skepticism coming from different quarters in terms of how to think about this.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Thank you. One thing, Megan, I just wanted to come back to. You said that in many ways, the novel coronavirus is quite like SARS-1, and yet we see this really different reaction playing out. What are the key differences between the two that you think have led to the really different impact and responses?
Yeah, from a virus biology standpoint, there are a couple things that are really important differences that we've learned as this pandemic has gone on. So for SARS-1 that happened in 2002-2003, it ultimately infected around 8,000 people and had a mortality rate of 10%. Some of the key differences is we were able to contain SARS-1. Really, I mean, there was some global spread. You know, Toronto had some outbreaks. There were some things that were related to airplane travel. But for the most part, it was pretty contained in Asia. And one of the reasons for that is you were able to identify who is infected with SARS-1 pretty rapidly. They had a more severe disease presentation in general, and they weren't contagious until several days into their infection. And the reason for that is SARS-1 had a preference for the lower airway. So it takes a couple days for the virus to be able to replicate and make you sick and really set up shop in the lower airway. And then you had to be coughing up some significant stuff for that to be able to be infectious to others. And this is not at all what we're seeing with SARS coronavirus 2. So SARS coronavirus 2 is able to be isolated from the upper airway. And as we're learning more and more about it, we know that people can shed virus and be contagious in their what we call pre-symptomatic phase. So they've been infected and maybe it will take a couple days for them to know themselves that they are ill, but the virus is replicating and they're able to spread, which means that if they're out and about and going to school or going to the grocery store, interacting with people at work or in their family, then they're able to transmit without knowing they're ill. And this makes it impossible to do the type of public health interventions where we were separating the sick people from the well people with SARS-1, which is why it has been so successful at spreading across the globe.
Interesting. Thank you. And does that mean that in February, do you think, either of you, that we probably already had community transmission happening in the U.S.? I'm trying to just remember when the first case was.
Yeah, there's some really good data out of Washington State. So our very first case was in mid-January. It was a traveler who had returned from Wuhan. He had been visiting some family there. He identified that he had symptoms and had seen, you know, on the CDC that he was supposed to seek medical care. He did everything right. He called ahead to the doctor. He wore a mask in the waiting room. He was hospitalized. He ultimately recovered. And then we thought that we had everything pretty well contained. And then there's this amazing story out of Seattle where there were some women who were working on a public flu surveillance study in the community. It had a bunch of different arms, including where some people would self-swab if they had symptoms and mail them swabs from the community, and then they would run flu tests. This is after the time that the genetic sequence of SARS coronavirus 2 was published, and they ended up also developing kind of a replicate of the PCR tests that the CDC and the WHO are using, and started running those samples for coronavirus as well, and found that some of the participants in their community flu study tested positive for SARS coronavirus 2. And when they sequenced the virus, they found that it was genetically incredibly similar, with only, I think, 3 individual mutations from that original returned traveler 6 weeks prior, which shows us that there had been ongoing community transmission for 6 weeks without us really knowing about it.
I would say, just to echo that the sense that we had of pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission in February, I think is an important thing to remember about that moment. From my sense of it as a non-scientist, there was a strong suspicion about pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission, perhaps pre-symptomatic transmission, but we were still waiting to see what could be confirmed about that. And so what Megan has just said about that retroactive sort of tracing of the cases in Washington State is absolutely true. But I think one of the main things that we have seen since February in terms of how we talk about this particular infection is that we are focusing on pre-symptomatic transmission and understanding that in a much more significant way than we did back in February.
Right. So Mary, that brings us to something that you mentioned in your opening response, which was both the way that people are trying hard to self-educate in this situation and the difficulty that they're having with that because of the conflicting or sometimes just incomplete information that we
have. And you and I had been talking previously about some of those difficulties as being the kind of normal difficulties associated with the science around this stuff. But I wonder if you could just react a little bit more broadly to that issue, and especially maybe you could start around the question of masks, which was mm-hmm. something that, you know, at the time we weren't talking about. We've had conflicting recommendations since.
Right. Yeah. I think one of the things that I have said repeatedly and then I keep trying to emphasize as a historian is that what we know about SARS-1 from 2002-2003, which Megan started out with, we know after years of study, and we're still counting this particular pandemic in the weeks, in days. And so there's a lot that is still being worked out. There's a lot that that we will know in a longer span of time. One of the things that I think is significant in terms of thinking about mask wearing, and, you know, I think this was really an interesting moment of looking at how public health communication works and sort of who's directing it and how it can work differently in at different municipal levels, at different state levels, and at national government levels. Because we had pretty clear messaging in some ways from the WHO back in January about who should be wearing masks that I really interpreted as being about wanting people not to hoard masks, not wanting lay people to buy up the kinds of surgical masks and personal protective equipment that that healthcare providers were going to need in order to keep themselves safe. And so our messaging back in January was that the people who needed to be wearing masks were those who were sick, although if in respiratory distress, no, don't wear a strong mask, but also people who were caring for the sick at home or in a healthcare context. And the guidance then was that people just sort of around in the streets needed to be focused more on hand hygiene, on social distancing, on staying away from one another, and not going out when you were sick, which is still all really sound advice, to wash your hand hygiene and your respiratory hygiene and not go out if you're sick. But over time, we saw this sort of back and forth. If masks can be protective for a lay person who's going to the grocery store, why not wear them? Who's to say that X person doesn't need a mask and Y person does need a mask? And for me, I've been really filtering that through the lens of what healthcare providers in well-provisioned hospitals, university hospital centers, but also in less well-provisioned hospitals and healthcare contexts have been saying about their access to materials. So for me, the first priority has always been, are people who are going to be interacting with someone who has ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome, do they have the protective equipment that they need for someone who is very sick with this disease, as opposed to those of us walking around who can stay away from other people, who can stay home. And I think that the shifting guidance to wearing a mask so that if you are asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic, if you don't know that you are sick and that you can provide some protective barrier from yourself as someone who could have COVID-19 to keep the people around you safe, that's a very different kind of guidance than what we were looking at earlier. And I think that really reflects the shifts in a broader knowledge and a deeper knowledge about pre-symptomatic transmission, as well as an effort to, I also think, to give people a sense of ownership and a sense of control about what they can do themselves to stay safer. One of the interesting things about this is that there's still studies being done and a lot of analysis of how well masks work. The amount of analysis of studies about aerosolization of this virus and of mask wearing and what works and what doesn't are really stacking up. But we still have a lot more to learn. So it goes back, I guess, also to that point of what we will know in the fullness of time and with more robust studies about mask wearing and about what we need to do.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think has been really interesting, and we were talking in our kind of pre-recording conversation a little bit about stuff we're seeing in our social media feeds and everything else. I think it's difficult for people to keep up with a lot of the changing guidance, even though that changing guidance reflects an improved understanding of the science of the pandemic and of the evolving social situation, right? So, Mary, what you were just explaining to us, to paraphrase, is that the advice has made sense all the way along, but the advice has differed because where we are in the course of this thing has been changing so rapidly. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
I think that's absolutely true. And I mean, I keep reminding my students and others, you know, count forward from the weeks of first notice about this in broader public consciousness. right? If you started at December 31st of last year, or if you're starting it in mid-January, you know, we're still at week X. And at week X, things are going to be uncertain. There's going to be research that hasn't been done yet. And we're going to be basing our responses on the best available data that we have at the time. So yeah, I think that's absolutely accurate.
There was a study that came out yesterday. I'm not sure if either of you saw it, from Cambridge, where the researchers had looked at whether or not conveying uncertainty undermined the credibility of scientific experts. And I guess reassuringly, they found that it did not, right? That people appreciated having the complexity and the uncertainty explained to them. Again, that's a general finding. It'd be interesting to know sort of sociologically how that varies, and according, you know, among which populations does that result vary?
As a scientist, I find that pretty reassuring. We, in our training, are pretty much taught never to use all or nothing statements, because nothing is impossible. You know, that's kind of our training, which makes communicating with the public really difficult, because I think as a scientific expert, you want to convey a certain amount of certainty, and that's just not part of the language that is built into our training, which makes it really difficult to say things like 100% sure that if you wear this mask, you will be protected, just because that's not something that we are trained to say. So I am super glad that that study shows that that doesn't undermine our expertise.
I'm really, really encouraged by that also. But, you know, Megan, I'm thinking back to the February event. One of the things that I thought that you and Dr. Mertz and Dr. Hartman did really nicely in kind of broadening out a sense of what was going on for the wider public was to say, we have three people who represent three different disciplines within the sciences, and these three people have a different perspective on the problem that we face and how it's going to operate, what we know, what we don't know. And none of you spoke speculatively, which I really appreciated, in terms of saying our worst case scenario is X and our best case scenario is Y, but rather said, these are the range of possibilities of what is out there. This is what we know about SARS-CoV-1, right? This is what we know about MERS after years of study. This is what we know about, you know, how respiratory illnesses operate based on our experience with influenza. And so the best that we can do is really just build on that knowledge base, which is a rich knowledge base, actually. It's not poor, I don't think, by any stretch, but build on that to deal with this really new, really challenging situation. And the newness of it is something that I think we need to communicate consistently when we are talking about it.
Absolutely. And I feel like we are able to use that background in both coronaviruses and respiratory illnesses in general. And then as, like you were saying, in week X, as studies are coming to light specifically about SARS coronavirus 2, we can then layer in new information that we didn't have before, which is probably part of the public's frustration, like you're saying, about evolving guidelines as we learn more.
Yeah.
It was interesting, Megan, when you were responding to my earlier comment about the study and talking about the way that scientists are trained to, you know, avoid statements of certainty, whatever. You know, this has been a real problem in the climate science domain, right? Mm-hmm. Where the sort of uncertainty has led to the manufacture of this idea that there isn't consensus, or that the science hasn't yet reached a conclusion, right? There's a way in which there the correct representation of uncertainty has been really problematic. And I wonder whether you see, either of you, any signs of that kind of situation here. You know, is the sort of inability to say with certainty, you know, X is happening, impeding the governmental response in important ways, and what could we do about that?
I think that the question of uncertainty and the question of developing knowledge is one of the key sort of fundamental things that we have to be communicating, because I think that it has then these ripple effects in terms of being able to process guidance from public officials and so forth. And so when we talk about what we know and how we know it, I think communicating that very clearly is really significant. So how long does it take for a clinical trial to happen? How long does it actually take for a vaccine on average to be developed? And it's not like we're just turning out vaccines left and right to all sorts of diseases. This is a difficult process. It's a challenging process. But then likewise, you know, what does it mean to understand or to model community spread or not? Now, those are things that the broader general public isn't necessarily going to be interested in learning the details of. But I think that the ability to say, when we are looking at case fatality rates, right, when we're thinking about case fatality rates and we're comparing case fatality rates for one disease to another disease, and we're breaking that down according to demographics, this is how we're measuring that. And this is why it matters that we're seeing seeing things sort of improve or change. One thing that I think has been amazing in the last month has been the extent to which the quote, flatten the curve rhetoric, with its accompanying charts and graphs of what an epidemic curve could look like, our best case and worst case scenarios, the extent to which that public knowledge, sort of flattening the epidemic curve, married with social distancing and staying home, married with policy changes like school closures and banning of large groups of people, has actually disseminated, I think, pretty well broadly to the general public. Although it hasn't permeated all pockets of resistance to government advice on how to live one's life, shall we say, and it hasn't sort of percolated into every single corner of the United States. But I've been really impressed with the extent to which people have picked up that information, tried to educate themselves about it by reading studies or by reading good science journalism, good health journalism about it, and have then put that into a plan of action, right? So this is a language. If you had said 3 months ago or 6 months ago, what does it mean to flatten an epidemic curve? 95% of the population, 99% of the general population would have had very little idea what you were talking about, right? Herd immunity, maybe, because we were talking about it with measles and outbreaks of measles and vaccination. But flattening an epidemic curve or social distancing, these were not things that were part of our common parlance. And now they are. And I don't know if that exactly speaks to the question that you were asking about uncertainty, but that's one place where we've seen a fundamental concept actually transmit or be transmitted effectively through a broad range of media, I think.
That, and also the reproductive number of a virus or how transmissible something is yep. Now a lot more common language than it used to be. Also zoonoses, viruses yep. that come from bats, like mm-hmm. the whole world is getting an education in virology, which they mm-hmm. didn't necessarily anticipate.
Yeah.
I was going to say the
number of people who can talk about the R-naught. And who know what the R naught is, or who will tell you, well, the R naught of COVID is lower than X, but it's greater than Y. And so that means we have to think about, you know, P, Q, and T. That's amazing to me. You know, I mean, that's a fundamental thing I teach in my history of public health classes, right? This is what we're talking about when we're talking about the spread of disease. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about herd immunity. You know, in 5 years or 2 years, I could have a group of students coming into my classes who would be like, yeah, we got that. We're done. We're good. You know, tell me something.
COVID, lady.
Yeah. Tell me something I don't know. Right? That's amazing to imagine. Although it's horrible that they have had to learn it in this sort of context. But I think the desire to self-educate is very strong.
The thing that concerns me around flattening the curve is that, you know, in a month's time, if the curve has been successfully flattened, and it turns out that we haven't seen nearly so many deaths as people might have feared. I've already started to see signs of this, again, in the corners of social media. Look, the deaths were tiny compared to the seasonal flu. This was all a conspiracy to crash the economy, or this was a massive overreaction. We didn't need to do this. Not understanding the counterfactual, right? That, well, the reason maybe we didn't end up with some of the more grim projections being realized was precisely because people took pretty dramatic action. So I mean, I don't know historically if there are analogs to anything like this, but it does strike me that, you know, winning that battle is not just a question of educating the public in the moment, but being able to make sure that the narrative is maintained going forward into the future, that the sacrifices that have been made, which are enormous, right? 16 million people filing for unemployment over the last 3 weeks is absolutely staggering, right? To be able to sustain a public discourse in which those kinds of sacrifices are justified, it's going to be super important that people really understand and internalize some of that information that you were just talking about.
I totally agree with that. I think one of the things that we will be pressed to do, but that we have to do effectively, is to probably right about now, given that the conversations about a plateau are starting to pick up traction, probably right about now or in the next few weeks, we need to communicate really effectively that when we're talking about flattening the curve and we're talking about maintaining measures that can keep pressure on healthcare resources low, or low enough to manage in particular contexts, that is a marathon rather than a sprint. And that one of the things that we have to be really deliberate about, and hopefully our governors and our mayors and our executives are thinking about this, we have to be really deliberate about pulling the trigger on releasing or lightening those distance restrictions. And we actually have some data and some lessons from the past from influenzas about what it means and what we see as an outcome when you pull that trigger to decrease social distancing, physical distancing measures too soon, right? So you see a second bump in infections, you see a surge. Now, would it be anything akin to the initial exponential curve that we have been looking at as we saw populations encounter this for the first time? I can't really speak to that, but I think one of the things that we'll have to be really deliberate about is trying to head off exactly what you're saying, Michael, in terms of opening things up too soon and then having more cases appear, or conspiracy theories about how this was not really necessary in the first place. We have to head that off in the past. The reason that we do not have our health systems broadly overwhelmed is because governors in many, many states just shut their states down. And because we closed schools early and preemptively before we had active cases that we knew about in those schools and so forth. And so really hammering that home, we'll have to do that. I think we will have data to do that. I think it will be clear that we can look at those curves of cases and we'll be able to do that. I think the one challenge to understanding that really, really comprehensively is going to be that we don't have a great sense of what our denominator is in this epidemic, because we don't know total numbers of cases of people that were actually infected versus those who ended up being tested versus those who end up in the hospital, you know, and that, I think that kind of data would have actually been a very powerful tool in arguing for our measures, our public health measures. If we were to say, look, we may have only had 8,000 people in this hospital system or in this state at any given time, but we actually had 40,000 cases in that city, right? And so, you know, that's one thing that I'm, if you're concerned about the kind of releasing of information and how we process that, I'm concerned about how, you know, the arguments about pandemic influenza in 1918, 1919 have been effective in part because we could really estimate and think about how many millions of people globally were sickened, and then compare that proportionally to our estimates of how many people in the US died and so forth. I think it's going to be difficult to make those arguments about how many millions of people have been infected with this coronavirus and who got sick and who had different kinds of illness, who died at home, who died in the hospital, because the data on that is just not clear right now when we need people to be able to really grasp that argument firmly.
Well, this brings me to something that I wanted to ask Megan about, which is, you know, we've heard a lot of talk and, you know, you should feel free to respond to what Mary just said as well. But, you know, we've heard a lot of talk in the last, just seems like, couple of days about antibody tests and immunity and all that sort of discussion coming along with this question of, you know, when we'll be able to sort of take our foot off the pedal and start to ease up on some of these things. So Megan, I'd be curious if you could speak also to a little bit about what we know about antibody tests and how they correlate with immunity and where the science is on any of that.
Sure. I actually was going to bring up this exact point to Mary's discussion. So I think the way to start is to explain the differences between the tests that we've been using and what an antibody test is. So right now, if you are ill and you are going to get swabbed, a nasal swab for a COVID test, that is a test that looks for the genetic material of the virus as it is actively replicating in your upper airway. This we know will be positive during the time of the acute illness. And there have been some studies that have had a couple of differences, but essentially somewhere in the first 2 weeks, maybe longer than that, but certainly in the beginning of your illness, that test will be positive if you are infected with SARS coronavirus 2. This is super helpful to say, you are infected right now, I need you to stay home so that you don't spread it to other people. What it doesn't tell us is, say, you had an illness 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and I swab your nose today, you might not still be shedding genetic material from your nose from that virus. So I might not be able to detect active replication of the virus right now at this instant. So that is where we kind of cross over into thinking about antibodies. So when you are infected with a pathogen, a virus, a bacteria, your body has a lot of really smart things that it does to respond to that pathogen. One of the things that it does is to make an immune response that is specifically targeted towards that virus. It's called the adaptive immune response, and it comes in the form of antibodies, and it takes somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to 14 days to make an effective antibody response against that pathogen. So that is where serology tests come in. So a serology test looks at a person's blood to see if an antibody was developed against a specific virus or bacteria. So a serology test for SARS coronavirus 2 can take a person's blood and see, has that person been infected with SARS coronavirus 2 at any point in the last several months? And it's long lasting to some extent. So that can give us a lot of information about the N, as Mary was saying. So if, for example, we tested everybody in Allegheny County to see if they had antibodies against SARS coronavirus 2, we would then be able to have a very reliable denominator to say this many people were infected during this pandemic. Now, it doesn't tell me what week they were infected. It doesn't tell me what month they were infected, but it tells me within the time that we knew that it was circulating in the community, this many people were involved. The next question that you had asked, Michael, was about kind of long-lasting immunity and if we know that the antibodies are going to be protective for additional infection. So since we're so new in this pandemic, we're still learning about this. I have seen some studies that do suggest that the antibodies that people are developing would be protective against subsequent infection. There's some data mostly in cells, also in monkeys, that suggest that that might be true. And what we had seen with SARS-1 is that antibodies were created and were protective against subsequent infection and tended to last at least for 2 years, and in some people would last a little bit longer. There's still a lot to learn about antibodies in SARS-2.
Right, but this would potentially be crucial, right? Because within that window of time, we might reasonably hope that an effective vaccine could be developed. And so I think that's why people have been latching on to this idea that maybe exposure will convey immunity, at least for a while, because that would buy significant time.
It would also be protective for those people that had already been infected. And when we're thinking about decreasing the R-naught or using social distancing to do that, if some of the people in a room are already immune to the disease, then they're not going to be infected. So that's also another way to decrease spread. It kind of gets to the idea of herd immunity. Now, the second sentence that I usually have to say now is, this does not mean that I want people to go to coronavirus parties so that everyone can get infected and then get immunity, because it's a terrible idea, because there's a lot of things that we don't know about this, including how much one person is going to spread to other people. And also, some young, healthy people are dying of this disease, and I cannot predict ahead of time which one of those people at the coronavirus party is going to be that person versus a person who handles it very well.
Right. But it's certainly a live issue in the sense that as this kind of discussion has started to develop into a almost to me a kind of like Black Mirror scenario of these kind of immunity passports that would allow people to basically go back out into the economy and work. And so for many people, there's the fear that without some sort of verification, they might be denied the opportunity to go, you know, earn a livelihood. I don't know whether we'll get into those sort of scenarios, but some of the stuff we've seen about the prospects of using phone apps to track people's movements and having immunity badges and all this kind of stuff raises some really significant social and political questions about the ways in which, you know, we've liked to say early on in this pandemic, well, you know, the virus doesn't discriminate. And that's, in a sense, true. But of course, our society discriminates. And so the impact of the virus tracks the discriminations that already exist in our society. And so, you know, I've heard some interesting conversations among some friends and colleagues about the scary but real prospect of people doing precisely what you were suggesting in order to kind of qualify themselves, in effect, to be able to survive economically. So I don't know how we'll navigate those questions, but they're not just science fiction.
Yeah. One of the things that I would say as you were talking about the kind of what I would associate it with is the idea of a health passport, right? You have to have certification of X or Y in order to be able to move in Z way. And so I sort of go back to historical examples and think about the ways in which we have tried to do this or regimes in the past have tried to do this and how it works and how it doesn't work. And there have actually been a lot of different examples historically of trying to screen for health for travelers, but also to require people to have some proof of health or proof of health status or disease status. For instance, in the colonial period, and this is a weird echo that I wouldn't have expected, but with my research on sleeping sickness, on trypanosomiasis, colonial regimes tried to implement measures where before workers could move around as caravan porters or as agricultural workers, they had to have been tested for trypanosomiasis or had to have undergone a treatment with some sort of a drug. And those were never really effective because the amount of control one has to have over the population really has to be incredibly strong in order for those sorts of mobility checks, but also the certification process to really be effective. And so I think that the question of how we would certify people to be active again economically and who could move around and who could not move around or who could engage in social activities again based on their immune status really is a distillation of the anxieties about when this is going to end. Right? That's what it speaks to me is what is this sort of, how do we know? Can we know? Is there a way of predicting or of managing when all of this ends and who gets to go back to normal? And I guess the thing that I would say is we don't know that right now. We have models for ways of thinking about it right now. But I would also sort of query whether any nation state in the current global regime is truly capacitated to manage that kind of a process. Maybe some private industry is, I'm sure, but that's one of the things that I think about. It speaks to anxieties, but it also speaks to our sense of sort of what our infrastructure really looks like. I don't think in the United States we're at all prepared or able to run a full-scale serological analysis of the entire population in order to know who's immune to this, right? I don't know, Megan, you can speak to that too, if you think that's even in the realm of possibility, but I wonder about that.
I mean, one of the things that we have unfortunately demonstrated during this pandemic is that our supply chain for testing materials on a global test everyone in the world scale is somewhat lacking. Because right now everyone's in competition for the same swabs and the same viral transport media and the same kits that you use for RNA extraction in the lab. And the scale, the demand for this has never been this high before. So it's been very challenging to be able to get the resources that everyone needs to do these tests. I imagine that serology for everyone would have some of the same limitations. I think the most useful way to use this data is really more on a population scale. So if you could say something like, the CDC has done a study and in a random sample of people in this area, we found that there is 60% immunity to SARS coronavirus 2. And we have defined that the threshold of 60% is enough to start to lift some of the restrictions. The problem here is that there's still a lot of unknowns, right? So we're not exactly sure where the threshold would be. But I think that kind of a scenario and how to use the data would be more both, I think, socially responsible and also more effective in saying, as a community, it is safe for all of us to go out, as opposed to more of a specific individual immunity passport.
That's really interesting. And it's a good segue, I think, to something that I'd like us to spend a little time on, which is thinking about what's been happening in Wuhan. We've seen just in the last few days that there's been a little bit of taking the foot off the pedal in terms of the restrictions. And we can talk about that in a minute. But first, to go back to where we started for a second, I think in February, certainly I speak for myself, I don't want to speak for the two of you, but certainly in February, when we were looking at the kinds of measures that were being taken to control the spread of the virus in Wuhan, I had a feeling that, wow, that's extreme. And I can't imagine that other places would be able to do anything broadly similar. And now it's like I sit at home in week 4 of my isolation, my perspective on that obviously has really evolved. So I'm curious whether you both had the same reaction or if you're surprised in any way by either the success or the limitations of other countries' abilities to impose the necessary measures. It's not a well-formulated question, I apologize, but to me, I'm constantly struck by that gap between my perception now and what I was thinking as things were unfolding 2 months ago.
I mean, I think there are a couple of indices that I use when I think about this, you know, as I look around and think about how people's behavior has changed and what has been possible. You know, one of the things that so in terms of what those indices are, it's, are people wearing any kind of a face covering, and are people actually really staying far apart from each other as they're walking around when I am out and about, you know, and do I see less traffic? Do I see fewer people around? So that's one thing that I sort of think about and am working with as I look at how we in the US are sort of processing and managing all of these things. The one thing that we said in February when we were looking at the hard lockdown of Wuhan, and I think one of the things that our colleague Jiajun Zhang did a really nice job of articulating was that Wuhan is a huge city. It's a transportation hub. It has these really important connections across China and international connections in terms of travelers. And so to lock down a city like this is really profoundly disruptive economically and profoundly disruptive for the population. If we just stay for a minute with the economic impacts of the closure of a city like Wuhan and how that then works for the closure of our own contexts, like we have seen that even if we were not looking at a situation where people could not leave their homes, that this has been profoundly disruptive. But it's also achievable, I guess, to encourage people to radically change their patterns of behavior. But I think that at least in Pittsburgh, we are not in a situation yet where people cannot leave their domiciles, right? They're where they are really supposed to only stay in their homes. We have the sort of loosening of restrictions for people to be outside in public areas as long as they maintain good social distancing, where we, you know, people can go out to the grocery store if they need to. And so I think that we're kind of calibrated to a difference in both the political landscape in which we live between here in Pittsburgh and Wuhan, but also calibrated to a different sense of urgency, right? So remembering that in February, when we were looking at Wuhan, we were really talking about Wuhan as the frontline for containment of this virus globally. And so those draconian measures in China were oriented around protecting the rest of the world from this disease. Now we are in a regime of community spread where we know community spread, we know asymptomatic or presymptomatic transmission. And so our goals are different. But yeah, I think about that also in the sense that we can see these sorts of things that we would not have really thought possible have now been implemented after a month of working with it. And I mean, indeed, Pennsylvania schools are going to be closed for the foreseeable future and into the school year. So that was not something that was really thinkable in February. We couldn't imagine a world in which that was going to happen, but it has emerged as being abundantly necessary to do so.
I think we've also seen a shift in when a city is shut down. So Pittsburgh is a smallish city, and we very preventatively took social distancing measures early. And I think that's one of the reasons why our case burden has been relatively low compared to other parts in the country and has been relatively stable as far as a day-to-day number of positive cases. But just thinking about in February, would we have shut down our city knowing that we didn't have many cases at all? I don't think we would have. So as we've watched this evolve throughout the world, it's been interesting kind of the time course for when people are making these decisions.
Yeah, I think that's interesting as well. The fact that here in Western Pennsylvania and in Pittsburgh in particular, we've the measures seem to have come early enough to maybe head off some of the worst. But I wonder if those differences that Mary was just alluding to would seem less if one were in New York.
When you say measures seem less, what do you mean?
Well, you said the differences, you know, some of the differences between Wuhan and here in terms of people still allowed to go out, the idea of sheltering at home or whatever. Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably also still not quite the same, but I think certainly in a place like New York where things were on the verge of being out of control where really serious measures have been implemented, where the health system is, you know, near the breaking point, if not at it. So the timing piece, I think, is just to say, is really interesting in that connection and the advantages of being really proactive, right? Which is in a way a thing that we wouldn't have contemplated, as Megan was saying.
I think one of the things about New York that's also significant. So having lived in New York for 7 years prior to eventually moving to Pittsburgh, I have some close contacts there and have kind of kept in touch just to be supportive of folks who are there. And I have one friend who lives in a high rise apartment building on the Lower East Side that is kind of a voluntary retirement community. Like, it's just populated by elderly people who want to live in the city. And when we've talked about her experiences of sort of mutual assistance, helping out neighbors who shouldn't be going out, you know, buying groceries for people. But I think that I look at the situation in New York and think about social distancing and advice about social distancing in two ways. On the one hand, there is some clarity that people are not necessarily always doing the kind of distancing that they would need to do in being out in public and being close together because of density, because of spaces. But there's also an extent to which, like, you cannot stay 6 feet away from people if you have to ride an elevator 20 floors down to the ground to get out to the grocery store, right? And if the sidewalks are narrow, you know, and so I think New Yorkers are, many of them, really putting out their best efforts to implement physical distancing, to stay at home when they need to. But grocery delivery is not something that's going to work, right, for everyone. And I mean, I remember saying this in February when we were talking about what the potential impacts were, and people were asking, you know, saying, well, if I have to stay home, I'll just order my food, or I'll be able to get my deliveries of pet food or toilet paper or what have you. And it's clear that that kind of an infrastructure in a situation like New York City, where you have high population density, high needs, high demands, but then also these are really significant pressure points. People are doing everything they can, and even that is not necessarily keeping them away from all other non-familial human contact. And so I think that's one thing that I think about in terms of how this is managed and what can be done, right, in a city like New York City versus a city like Pittsburgh versus Seattle or San Francisco. And it's also been really fascinating to see how different municipal authorities and different state authorities have used different rhetoric, different language. The mayor of Chicago basically just told everybody to start behaving themselves and to stay out of the parks. But, you know, there are different mayors and different governors have been taking different approaches to this as well, which I think is something that we would not see in, at least at an official level, in a context like Wuhan in China.
I think it's interesting too to think about the places that are hardest hit. So New York City, and thinking about how fear and the reality of, you know, I now know 6 people who have had this, as opposed to some place that isn't hit as hard, might also have implications for how strongly people are following the social distancing rules.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think having personal stories is significant. And I will also say, like, I think if you have contacts with people who are healthcare workers. So if you have an aunt who is a nurse, or a cousin who is a nurse, or a cousin who's an orderly, or an uncle who's a doctor, and you're thinking about those people, whether or not you're considering them truly frontline healthcare workers, that has also been interesting for me. Like, one of the things that I've been trying to track over time is the changes in approaches to homemade masks among different cohorts, you know, sort of people who are in my networks and people who are talking about this. And there's one sector of people who've really been agitating for conversations about mask wearing for a long time. And that is scholars of East Asia, who have experience with mask wearing during respiratory illnesses, and who are talking about what they see and how this operates, and sort of comparisons across different national populations and national statistics. But then another cluster of people who have been talking about mask wearing or making homemade masks or healthcare workers' supplies are the families of people who are going into clinical contexts right now. And I think that's also, you know, Megan, if we're thinking about information and how information about who is touched by this disease percolates outward, it doesn't have to just be somebody who has been seriously ill or somebody who has died. It's that fear and that risk of knowing that your loved ones are out there operating in this world, right? Grocery workers, people who are mail carriers, sanitation workers, right? This is something that actually has a really broad social reach, right? But the other thing that's also really interesting is that then is differentiated according to how we understand the virus spreads, right? So risks for different people are, you see this sort of worked out again and again, risks for different people within society are being kind of reworked and processed through understanding of aerosol spread, droplet spread, fomites. And that's, that also muddies the waters in a really fascinating but unsettling way.
I wonder if either of you has a view or information about exactly what's happening in terms of the relaxation of some of the restrictions in Wuhan and how we would track, you know, what measures might be in place to kind of manage that transition, right? I mean, once again, we're looking there, I think now with a much better understanding that there are going to be really important lessons to be learned as these, as we try to figure out what it looks like to move into a slightly more relaxed, though still guarded posture towards dealing with the virus. So what kinds of steps are being taken? What kind of tracking do we want to see? How will we know and you know whether we've gone too far and will we be able to sort of keep up with that in real time?
I don't really know, Michael. I mean, I don't know. I don't think we know yet.
No, it's It may be that the question is just one we can't answer at this at this point. But you know, in the absence, so Megan was talking earlier about antibody tests and
serological
for immunity, and you know, we don't know quite exactly what level of exposure we need in the general population. I mean, is it the case that in the absence of better information on that stuff, we're really just kind of
winging it?
Is that where we are?
We'll go on and say that we'll use our best hypotheses based on previous data. But we, you know, we haven't been in exactly this situation before. And I loved your question. I just don't know a lot of the specifics of what they're relaxing and how they're studying it. So I think they have a lot to teach us about how they handle this because they were the ones that were there first.
I mean, one thing that I, having just been listening to NPR, there was a reporter who had gotten back into Wuhan and was just talking with people about their process. And there are two things that actually stood out from some of the conversations that we are starting to have about what it looks like in Wuhan to relax measures in some capacity. And one is that, you know, as a transit hub, the, I think authorities are being very deliberate about how many people are traveling, how they are allowed to travel, sort of maintaining distance on a train car and so forth. But there was an interview with an individual that was really striking, you know, where he said, you stay inside your house for this long and it's hard, you know, you sort of go crazy. And so we're trying to figure out what our new normal is and what this means now for all of us who have been cooped up for so long. And I think, and that I think is something to sort of keep simmering, not necessarily on the back burner, but sort of keep our sort of thoughts around is the kind of broader social impacts for what it is like to live in these really interesting times, but then also what it will be like in the aftermath. And so one of the things that's been really fascinating for me right around early March, late February, early March, I started getting queries as a historian about what people had done after the influenza pandemic in 1918-1919. So earlier in February, the conversations were almost solely oriented around how does COVID, or once it was called COVID, how does this virus potentially compare to the H1N1 1918-1919 influenza in terms of case fatality rate, in terms of number of people infected? And then as we started to think about this as a reality for ourselves and the need to alter our daily lives, the conversation started to shift toward, okay, so what were the 1920s like? Right? Did this give us that? How was influenza in 1918-1919 related to racism? How was it related to the Jazz Age? How was it related to the Great Depression? And that kind of grasping for understanding what comes next, I think, is something that I also see us working out in real time globally as a human population that is really fascinating, but also not full of a lot of certainty. Right? We just don't know. I would imagine. Yeah, we just don't know.
I had heard an interesting piece about not social distancing as we know the term now, but, you know, seats on airplanes are a lot closer together than they used to be in the past because we've gone to favoring smaller planes that fly more efficiently with more people on them. But how will things like that change? Will we still pack NFL stadiums to the same degree that we have in the past. So even in kind of a daily life sort of things that we used to take for granted, how much will any of that change, if at all, after this is over? I think it's going to be something interesting to watch for too.
The thing that I wonder is, will people reflexively stand further apart in line for an extended period of time? Will people reflexively sit one seat apart in a way that doesn't indicate rudeness, but rather, or sort of a lack of wanting to be close to someone, but that indicates reflexive social distancing that we've been encouraged to take on? That's something I think will be really interesting to see as things play out, let alone mass gatherings, you know?
Yeah. Well, and what's going to happen to little kids? You know, as a pediatrician, I think about 2 and 3 year olds that are told over and over again, no, we can't hug. No, we can't be that close to each other. What's that going to do kind of to the development of the social norms of that group of people too?
Yeah. My 6-year-old was educated by his school about washing his hands for the entire ABCs. So we had been talking about hand washing and not touching our faces and so forth. And then I listened to him as he was washing his hands one day, and he was going through the entire ABCs really methodically. You know, he'll critique how soapy my hands are if we're together. That's fascinating for a young person to have that kind of capacity. But I think like classroom dynamics and school dynamics are going to be a really interesting thing to see play out. And also, you know, the extent to which we understand that connectivity with people on screens and remotely can be really a lifeline and really, really important for all of us in sort of weathering this and having solidarities through it. But at the same time, I think I am certainly recognizing the difference between a Zoom dinner party or a Zoom dinner gathering and an actual dinner gathering, you know, and you know, what does it mean to put your device away and how does that operate? And also, I mean, I have a great deal of sympathy and empathy for people who are desperate to see their families and to celebrate together and to manage. I think, you know, the idea of having someone in your family die of COVID-19 or die of anything right now and not be able to gather to mourn collectively and to process things as you normally would is really devastating. Those of us who don't live close to our families and can't sort of wave to them from the front porch, or, you know, when we're dropping off groceries or something, you know, these are things that I think we'll see playing out over time. And again, this is one of those cases where looking to how people have managed these things in the past, there are, I think, really robust conversations right now about community messaging and community solidarities during and after the Ebola outbreaks in 2014, 2015 in Western Africa, as well as the sorts of touchstones that people may have in the US around polio, you know, or other kind of family stories. We're really going to have to look to those to understand that societies have moved through things like this in the past, and they have come out on the other side. You know, it demonstrates incredible resilience, but also leaves in its wake a lot of collective trauma and grief and mourning that we're going to be dealing with too.
Well, I think that's maybe a good place to
proper downer
conversation for now. I think the point that we have a lot to learn from elsewhere, both from the past and from other places, about these kinds of experiences is one that is a great place for the Global Studies Center to wrap up on, right? The kind of exceptionalism that so frequently structures the way Americans view ourselves and view the world is really a limitation. And I think this experience has shown that. You said, Mary, something about people really grasping for an understanding of what comes next. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go not very far out on a limb here and suggest that it might be great to touch back in with you both again in a little while, and that there might be more interesting things to talk about as our understanding of the situation evolves. But for now, let me just thank you both for taking the time this morning for this really fascinating conversation, and you know, keep well.
Thank you so much for bringing us together again.
It was great to catch up. Thanks so much.